It's so bizarre, this book. It's brilliant. It's just brilliant. I haven't had as much fun in this as you. I mean, you know, reading these strange, exotic,
yeah,
kind of hot-housed madness. Anyway, let's not go too soon. Should we start?
Yeah, why don't we?
Have you got some chat you can use?
Got a bit of chat.
Yeah. A bit of chat.
A bit of chat. Right. Welcome to another edition of Backlisted, sponsored by Unbound and coming from the kitchen table in Unbound. I am John Mitchinson, publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller. I'm the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And as usual, we're joined by the writer and bon viveur, Matthew Clayton. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, everyone.
And our special guest this week to discuss Nella Larsen's passing is Sarah Churchwell, Professor Sarah Churchwell.
Well, thank heavens you said that.
Professor,
I was going to storm out of here.
Professor of the Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University
of London.
Of London. Also an author, one of my favourite books of recent years, Careless People, which is a brilliant reconstruction of what was happening at the time F. Scott Fitzgerald was writing Gatsby. So a literary detective work, but also brilliant reading and brilliant contextualising of that novel. And I guess that only leaves me to say, Andy,
no, we're not doing that this week.
No,
because...
We both read the same thing.
I don't know if you'd heard, but a couple of weeks ago, David Bowie died.
I did.
And we were all very sad about that.
Very sad.
One of the things that went into circulation after David Bowie died was a list that he had pulled together about 5 years ago of his 100 favourite books. And I've noticed, like, on Twitter, there's a Bowie book group hashtag already for people who are going to read the challenge of the 100 Bowie books.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if
I'm a voracious reader. Everybody, one of the things that's come out of all the people memorializing him is that he was never not with a book in his hand.
Yeah. I love that story about how in his latter years he had passed anonymously around New York by carrying a Greek newspaper so that people just think, oh, there's a Greek bloke who looks like David Bowie. Anyway, so we've got the list of 100 books. Yeah. We'll try and put it up on the website or on the Facebook page if you haven't already seen it. But I thought it would be fun just to go around and see, truthfully, how many of these 100 books we'd all read. I will show my hand first. I've read 29, and that includes Private Eye magazine and Viz. So I managed to crawl my way to 29. And actually, it would have been 28 if it wasn't for Sarah choosing Passing for us to read, because Passing is one of the books on this list.
Well, I have to say, I also added, Passing was added another one to me. I feel quite good. I thought I hadn't done terribly well. I've 36.
Very good.
In the lead.
Well, it's not really a competition, is it, Matt? Let's be honest. But there are some funny ones. And the ones that I haven't read are funnier than the ones that I have. I mean, I think I've already said on this podcast, I never actually read 1984. Still not read.
Yeah, 1984, yeah. The books on this list that I really want to read, really want to read Puckoon by Spike Milligan, which I've never read.
Which is great.
I really want to read American Way of Death by our old backlisted favourite, Jessica Mitford, which
also
I've never
not
read.
On my list.
And think. English Journey by J.B. Priestley.
I have read.
And how's that?
Oh, it's wonderful.
So I'm the paltry 29. You're 36, Matthew.
How many?
I clocked up 22, but what I found interesting was that lots of them, I'm really not sure whether I've read them or not. Billy Liar, have I read that?
You know,
I can't really remember.
Yeah. I only read Billy Liar last year. Having loved the film for 30 years, I only read the book last year, and I actually found the book disappointing. Isn't that terrible? It's because Schlesinger made several really significant changes to the plot in the film, which I'm so used to that when I read the novel, I thought, that's a shame.
Oh. This is maybe a subject for another podcast, that misremembering stuff because you've seen film adaptations. Yeah. Whether things have changed in the film, and I can't now. I mean, it would be hard for me to be able to remember much of anything. I think don't you recall about less than 5%? I mean, the plot for some novels
I thought was almost
beyond me. You know,
I thought when I was doing it was the way that I could work out whether I'd read it or not was whether I remember the cover. It wasn't whether I could remember the content.
Let me tell you, as a key book selling skill, Sarah.
Well, you know, I have to say I'm a bit of a ringer here because I'm a professor of American literature, and Bowie seems to have quite a predilection for American literature.
Don't tell yourself down.
There are an enormous number of American novels on this list, surprisingly so. And I am competitive as well as American. So I have to say, with some great pleasure, that I have read 48 and left, and left you all in the dust.
Yes, you have. Did your 40?
I was cross. I was cross that I hadn't made 50 because I thought I was so close to the halfway mark.
Did you? Did your 48 include any issues of the Beano?
I have never read the Beano.
There you go. So easily get to 50.
Or the Spike Mulligan.
Mulligan.
Sorry, I don't even know his name. Yeah. So I'm Mulligan's too. So I am. I clearly have much reading to do.
I've just seen one more. I have read that.
See?
I have read Last Exit to Brooklyn.
There you go. Me too. That's one of
37
them.
37, Andy. I'm really sorry.
But Bowie, there's a very strong presence here of 20th century American novels, and that's my field. So it would be really bad if I hadn't read them, honestly. It is a little bit like he took one of my courses. You know, it's like tick, tick.
Is there a major American novel that you haven't read? Have you got a guilty secret?
Of course I have guilty secrets. I just have to think which one it is.
You honestly read John Dos Passos? I don't know.
I have actually read John Dos Passos. You know why? Because, first of all, he was a friend of Fitzgerald's. I haven't read that much Upton Sinclair. I had to read The Jungle. We had to read it in high school.
Has anybody read anything other than The Jungle by Upton Sinclair?
Not that I'm aware of. But the thing was that in high school, I was a girly swap because I was the kind of girl who was going to go on and become an English professor. So I read books even when I didn't like them. I just doggedly made my way through to the end.
I know how that feels.
And we were given the USA trilogy. Exactly. Now I've liberated myself from that. I don't have to do that anymore.
Who would like to hear me talk about Finnegan's Wake?
Moving swiftly on.
And Matt, our producer, Matt. We can't leave Matt out of this. How many?
I only got to 20. Nice. That's including the comics. And that's basically because I've read every one of those music biographies. Including the Little Richard book, which is...
A great book.
John Savage's Teenage is a fantastic book. A Wop-Bop-A-Luba is a brilliant book.
Teenage?
And Sweet Soul Music by Peter Goralnik. That's a wonderful book. And the weird thing is I've never heard a record by David Bowie.
But anyway, Passing was on this list, which was it a coincidence?
It was a total coincidence.
A novel that isn't on this is John Brackby, Breakdown.
Okay, so now normally at this point or earlier in Backlisted, what we would do is John and I would ask one another which books we've been reading. And we've both been reading the same book because I read a novel.
You made him.
I made him. I read this novel by the painter John Brackby called Breakdown over Christmas. And I genuinely feel it's the most... extraordinary, in the true sense of that word, novel that I've read for years. And halfway through it, I emailed John and said, please, please buy a copy of this book from Abe secondhand. It's never come out in paperback. We have to be able to talk about it on Backlisted. So before we talk about it, I'm just going to say a bit for anyone who doesn't know who John Brackby was. He was a painter. A prolific painter, and in fact there is a retrospective exhibition of his work opening at the Gerwood Gallery in Hastings this weekend, the first retrospective of his work. He was incredibly successful for a short period in the late 1950s and he was early to mid-60s.
He was to British painting what John Osborne was to British drama, wasn't he? It was kitchen sink.
He was a leading light of the kitchen sink school, a group of radical realist painters who painted things like chip fryers and cornflake packets in really thick paint on massive canvases. And so he was kind of fated from the late 50s to the mid-60s, in which time he wrote four novels, of which Breakdown is the first. And then he kind of fell out of favor after the mid 1960s. But he kept painting prolifically to the extent that he is estimated, is only estimated because people don't actually know that there are at least 3,000 John Brackby canvases in existence,
which is pretty amazing.
Did Tony Hancock base any characters?
There are some amazing similarities between The Rebel, the film in which Tony Hancock plays a painter.
Yeah.
When asked how he mixes his paint, he says, in a bucket with a big stick, and so on.
And Brackby's paintings were the paintings. His actual paintings were the ones that Gully Jimson, the hero of the Joyce Carey novel,
hero.
Well, you know, anti-hero, yeah. Whatever, protagonist, antagonist, and
yeah,
the Horse's Mouth, which was filmed in round about the sort of mid-60s.
Was 59.
59.
So, and this is
a year before. Well, Brackby's novel
I'm
came
speculating.
Out.
That Brackby, who became very famous as a result of these massive paintings being in the film The Horse's Mouth, may have approached a publisher or have been approached by a publisher to say, well, you know, you're associated with a film of a book. Do you have any books? His biographer, I'm just going to quote his Brackby's biographer, who described Brackby in the introduction of the biography as, quote, he was violent, alcoholic, completely self-absorbed, pathologically shy, combined pornographer and prig. He believed that drinking and masturbation were necessary for the self-loathing he needed to make art. And the journalist Andrew Lambert has said John Brackby was a monster who possessed great talent. I knew him quite well over the last decade of his life and even contemplated writing a book about him before I learnt enough to put me off. I'm saying all this because the novel breakdown is clearly autobiographical. Yeah. And normally on Backlisted, we read the blurbs on the backs of books, as you know. I'm just going to read you the blurb on the inside jacket of the novel breakdown. It says this. John Brackby writes, "This is a study of a man's decline. The man is James Brady, successful artist. Behind the lurid episodes, which include everything from near rape and murder to lunacy and a bicycle chain battle, is to be found a serious and continual explanation of the man's mental state, an exhaustive, careful, analytical explanation of why James Brady enacted the rake's progress. Superficially read, the book will present a juicy story. For those who want a more serious side to their reading will, I hope, find that also in the book. James Brady is presented unsympathetically, and the book has many comic passages. Now and again, I have drawn incidents from my own experience and distorted and exaggerated them into the regions of pure fiction. I shall be highly amused if anyone thinks this book is autobiographical, for if it was, I would indeed be an awful mess. Capital A, capital M. That is the best blurb. That is the best blurb we've had on Backlisted.
Actually, it doesn't let up from there. I mean, it is extraordinary, the energy of this book. The structure is a complete nightmare. It's basically the story of a breakdown, or sort of two breakdowns, because as he points out later on in the book, the sensible thing to have done would have been a breakdown that would have ended in a suicide. But no, he then, I have to say, the book is full of extraordinary, lurid illustrations.
That's one of the wonderful things about
and
it
the,
as well.
Some of the prose is amazing. He also does, it put me in mind of B.S. Johnson, who
yes.
we were discussing on the last podcast. He puts in a gratuitous scene, okay, in the middle of the book, which is a sort of basically a murder scene, you know, lots of blood everywhere. And he is obviously self-consciously introduces it as a piece of dime novel writing. And then the asides to the reader are one of the joys of this book. At this point, we feel we have done our duty by the schoolboys, labourers and excitement-starved clerks of this country. We feel that we have jeopardised our claim to great literary recognition and that we may not now get the Nobel Prize for Literature. We see ourselves sadly paying in our royalties at the bank to an adoring bank clerk while the bank manager looks disapprovingly from the doorway of his office. We see that as we leave the bank, an errand boy excitedly points us out to his friend and a book critic spits at us as we pass him. Such self-sacrifice must surely be rewarded in the halls of heaven, but we are sad. We did so want to be another Faulkner or Joyce. What will our old headmaster say?
It's so funny you chose that. I picked up the next thing about that. This is a thing that I read and thought, God, I wish I'd written this.
Yeah.
Okay. He says, now, dear reader, I'll present you with another small event in Brady's life, and you'll have to work out unhelped whether it is relevant to our story or whether it's hoop-de-doodle. After all, if you want to pick holes, go and read a part of William Faulkner's noble novel Sanctuary, which I'll quote for you. Remember, Faulkner was given the Nobel Prize, and this is considered his best work. Now get your fault-finding mind on this. Hooray! And then he goes on to say, and this is true, everybody. This is true. John Brackby speaks the truth. We have to be tolerant to enjoy literature, dear reader. Now, if you have learnt tolerance, you can go ahead and enjoy the reading of the one great, and we mean great in the aesthetic sense, book that the egotistical James Joyce wrote about himself. You can pick holes in the greatest, but it won't do you any good. That's great.
It is brilliant.
Now, having said, you know, if you're interested in novels from the 60s and the art scene, or just crazy lost outsider work, Bratby wrote four of these novels. And when I started reading them, I was thinking, why isn't this in print? Why hasn't somebody picked this up? And as I read on, I discovered why, which is very unfortunately, I have to strongly qualify my recommendation of this
Absolutely.
Book by the fact that it contains some really unpleasant racial and domestic violence-related material, which although Bratby would probably claim that it's part of the method of portraying
the west of the world that he's writing about, the mind of the
I found pretty hard to read, actually.
Particularly.
So this afternoon I tracked down his dealer, his art dealer, not his drug dealer. Or maybe I did.
Whatever, I have to say, whatever he was on.
Bon vivant.
And that was interesting because the guy that runs the gallery that deals in his work still said that his biggest influence and the thing that he felt closest to was Colin Wilson and The Outsider. And he said he was friends with Colin Wilson, which I think gives it a little context. But he also said that Bratby quite literally just tossed these off as quickly as he could. You know, he wrote the books really quickly. He was just interested in earning some money from them. But he actually, at one point, felt that that's what he was going to do. He was going to become a writer rather than an artist.
You know, the thing about this novel breakdown, there are passages of utter brilliance, which I don't think a more literary writer would be able to access. There's all sorts of stuff about the way in which he uses colour in prose is something a painter would do.
Yeah.
And also how he's brilliant at taking little prose snapshots of scenes in a street, for instance. It's absolutely terrific.
One last thing. So there's also kind of in jokes in there in a kind of B.S. Johnson way. So the artist in the book, the main character in the book, passes a gallery and they see someone with really terrible paintings of hands, and that's a joke about Bratby himself being known to being very bad at painting hands. So I think there's lots of those. It's not just autobiography. There's lots of little jokes in there that if you knew him, you'd completely understand.
I do feel I need to also interject for the record, in case anybody is paying attention to the claims that he was making, that Sanctuary is not considered William Faulkner's best novel by anybody. Except possibly Bratby.
I edited down what Bratby actually writes. Yeah. I'll share
it with
you
after. Does it involve a corn cob?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Of course it would involve the corn cob.
That is more or less the only thing that any of us remember.
Nobody thinks that Sanctuary is Faulkner's best novel.
So I found this thing, Matthew. I thought, Matthew, I wonder if Matthew will get this to this before I do, but I guess you didn't. I was just talking about Puckoon by Spike Milligan, one of David Bowie's 100 books. And the actor Neil Pearson is also a rare book dealer. And he is currently selling a first edition of Breakdown by John Bratby, dedicated to Spike Milligan. And I'm just going to read out the dedication to Spike Milligan, okay? To Spike, 30th May 1968. I'm reading Puckoon with the midday cup of tea. I'm at this point in time, halfway through chapter 5. Compared with Puckoon, my book has a rollicking sense of fun, a deep appreciation of the squalid, capital S, and a comprehensive cast. Not that Puckoon has not. For reading all 336 pages of this book, which Maggie has done, there is a prize. This can be obtained by making application to Number 7 Hardy Road, Blackheath, when there is a full moon in conjunction with a Z in the month and in a leap year. The colour of the nature of this book is black. Wine to accompany reading, burgundy. All the best, John.
Brilliant. Those with strong stomachs, I think. It's extraordinary. And as you say, bits of it, I think, are as good as any English novel published since the war.
And clearly, as a figure, I'd just repeat that the exhibition at the Gerwood down in Hastings is the first retrospective of Bratby's work. And they actually issued an appeal to members of the public saying, if you have a Bratby, please share it with us. Please bring it down. And Andrew Mayle, our friend Andrew Mayle, who's going to be a future guest on a Backlisted, pointed out to me that in the Reggie Perrin novels by David Nobbs, CJ has a John Bratby hanging on his office wall. So
apparently it's an adaptation of a Judith Krantz novel where all the art in it is Bratby.
You're kidding.
Which sounds pretty...
Really?
Oh, that's the best fact I've heard of.
I can't imagine how that has happened, but apparently it's true. My last little thing on Bratby is I just love, because with my unbound hat on for a moment, I love to see that, you know, when we're thinking we're breaking new ground by putting interesting levels in for books, funding of books, on the inside flap of this first edition, you could send off to Bratby, the first 200 readers who responded got a signed print of some of the some of the lurid and quite explicit illustrations of the book, which is great. I particularly like that one. That's the graph paper of his breakdown, which looks a little bit like a pair of breasts.
Of course. Funny that.
Right. Anyway, enough of Bratby.
We'll pick this up again after some marvellously witty and interesting adverts.
Nella Larson.
What a crunching gear change.
Richardson.
I couldn't think of any link, tenuous or otherwise.
We ask our guests on Backlisted to choose a book, and Sarah came back pretty much straight away, didn't you, with Passing by Nella Larson. And I will confess immediately that I had never heard of it.
Which is the reason I chose it.
And you actually made me feel better by saying, well, the reason I want to choose it is because I don't think many people in the UK have heard of it.
And I hadn't heard of it.
And not that many people in the US, for that matter. It's growing. And it's something that people encounter if they take classes on writers like Larson. And we'll talk about the kind of context in which she appears, I'm sure. But it's only in the last 10 or 20 years that she's starting to gain any kind of traction. And she was one of the forgotten writers of her era for many decades. And yes, and in my experience still, is very much not known here. And since I was told that your whole raison d'etre was to bring books back into circulation that people have forgotten about.
Good ones, that's the thing, ones worth recovering. Yeah.
So before we talk maybe about Passing itself, I wonder if it would be helpful, could you just tell us a bit about Nella Larson, who she was and where she came from and where she went to as well. That would be great.
Yeah, well, Nella Larson is best known for two very, very brief novels that are often published together. And I see several editions around our table are, in fact, these doubleheaders. Her first novel was called Quicksand, which came out in 1928 and is reasonably autobiographical. It's very much drawn on her own experiences. And then this novel, Passing, which came out in 1929. And they're both about 100 pages. They're really brief novellas or long short stories, if you like, even. Larson herself was the daughter of a white father and a black mother. Her father was Danish. Larson is spelled S-E-N. And in the 1920s in America, of course, it was still Jim Crow, the American name for apartheid. And Americans don't like it when I call it apartheid, but that's what it was, and that's what we should call it. And the rule, as I'm sure many people know, the law was what was known as the one-drop rule, which said that if you had one drop of quote-unquote Negro blood, you were legally considered a black person, and that meant that you didn't have the legal rights of a white person. So you were a second-class citizen. So if you were mixed race, you were black. And of course, that rule was instituted in the 19th century by slave owners so that they could continue to rape their slaves and create more slaves for themselves. And they didn't want their slaves to inherit their property if they were allowed to be white. So what they said was, you followed the condition of the mother, which was the slave. And if you had any black blood in you, you were considered legally black and therefore able to be enslaved. But of course, the laws of biology don't follow the laws of racism. So the more mixing of races that you do, the whiter and whiter that people become. And then it becomes hard to tell whether somebody has quote unquote black blood or not. The question really is whether they have black skin. And so America got itself into a massive tangle from which it has not emerged. Of course, we still call Obama the first black president, even though he is half black and half white in exactly the way that Nella Larson was. So Larson, like many people of mixed race in the era, found herself in it was a really difficult social position to hold. It was the academic word that people like to use is liminal, right? She was in this kind of neither here nor there, and not fully embraced by the black community, not embraced at all by the white community. And she actually ended up leaving America for a while. She went to Denmark, where she hoped that she would find a less racist experience with less racist people. And in fact, what she found was they were less virulently racist, but she was exoticized. So she was very much kind of, she was passed around as this kind of bird of paradise and this kind of
Josephine Baker.
And so, she felt often wrote about the fact that she just felt that she was not at home anywhere and there was nowhere where she was accepted. And this sense of shuttling back and forth between two racial identities is something that she deals with in both books. So both Quicksand and Passing are about what it means to be a light-skinned black woman in America in the 1920s, trying to find some sense of what your identity might be. And what Larson makes it so amazing about, and so ahead of her time, is that she makes this very much a sexual question as well for both, both novels. It's not simply a question of race, as if race were a simple question, but it's not merely a question of race. It's also always with Larson about sexual identity, and it's particularly about female power and how that relates to sex and race and indeed class as well. And Passing involves all of these things, and Larson was acutely aware of these issues.
I want to come on in a minute to just talking about the artistic and literary scene that she made herself part of and indeed sprang from, because I think that's an important part of understanding the book as well. But before we do that, I'd like to get Matthew and John maybe just say what you thought of the book, coming to it blind.
I absolutely loved it and read it quickly and then read it again, because I one of the things that is so remarkable about it is the precision of the language. I've rarely read a book where the emotional nuance of simple domestic conversations has been better realised, leaving aside, as it were, the subject matter of the book, just purely as a technical exercise in rendering thoughts, in responses, in painting delicate but accurate pictures of how those emotions change within a conversation. It's a remarkable, I think, a remarkable novel, and a remarkable... The thing that I came away with it feeling strongly is only fiction can do this. Only fiction can unpack such a... I mean, at the time, as you say, Sarah, at the time, the idea of Passing, of getting away with pretending to be a white for a black person, that was a huge issue at the time.
It was dangerous.
It's still a kind of... this issue, is, as we all know, is still fraught. But what fiction can do that almost nothing else, that no amount of sociological exegesis can, is what it feels like to be that person, what motivates you to be that person who is doing that.
Yeah.
And then we'll go into more detail about that, the central relationship in the novel, which is a friendship between two black women or women of mixed race. So I found it completely extraordinary.
I liked it too. Matthew, what did you
get? I read it on the Kindle, and that was a kind of interesting experience because I knew nothing about the book, and I skipped the introduction. I didn't bother reading the introduction. So I went straight in. To start with, it took me 20, 25 pages to even work out what era it was set in. And it's a weird way to read a book on a Kindle like that, knowing nothing about it. You feel kind of unstable to begin with. So you have no idea what direction the book's going in.
How did you figure out what the era was? What was the marker?
I looked it up in the
end. Oh, you went
So I was like, because there's a bit in it where there's a car in it. Originally, we thought it was in the 19th century. Then a car appears, and I was like, God, it's in the 1950s. Right. And then, you know, I looked it up and discovered it's 1929. So that was interesting. The thing I liked most about it was the dynamics of the friendship, the central relationship. Because specifically the ambiguity around the way that attractiveness, the role that attractiveness played in that relationship. Yeah. I thought that was, I loved that.
One of the things I'd like, we're going to talk about, I think, is the difference between reading this book context-free and then beginning to understand more about the context around it. I had a similar experience to John, which is that I read it and it made quite an impact on me. And then I read it again, having found out more about it. Yeah. Now, we have to issue a warning at this point. On Backlisted, we'd normally try and remain spoiler-free. But we had a conversation before we started, and we said we can't really talk about this book and the subject of this book without talking about the ending. It's such an important part. So listen, if you haven't read this book and you want to read it based on what we've been talking about, switch us off now and come back later, yeah? Okay, so bye. Now, okay, they've
Don't
gone now.
To come back, though.
They've gone now, everyone. We can talk about. So, we normally, as I said earlier, we normally read a blurb from the back of the book. I'm not going to read a blurb from the back of the book. I'm going to read the first review that was published anywhere in the world of this novel. It was by a writer called Mary Reynolds. It was in the New York Telegram on April the 7th, 1929. And under the headline, Passing is a Novel of Longings.
Pretty good.
This is what she wrote. I can't say whether I'd pass or not, and you really ought to have an opinion before you give your answer to Passing. It is the story of two negresses, both light enough to pass for white. One does. She marries a white husband. She always has hankering for her race, freedom, rhythm. The other marries a dark husband, has a dark child, passes when convention makes it more convenient, and is happy in her Harlem life. After years of separation, the two women meet. The one who went white longs for the comforts of the one who stayed black, so she comes to Harlem. Trouble results because the faker fell in love with the true one's husband. When the faker fell out of the seventh story window, the problem was solved for Miss Larson.
And here's the spoiler.
Mary Reynolds continues, my objection to the book is that Nella Larson didn't solve the problem. Knocking a character out of a scene doesn't settle a matter. The problem presented of the Negro passing is vital to me, and Nella Larson knows how to present it so. It is more a question than it is literature.
That's interesting.
Now, most of the reviews of this book were pretty positive, but lots of them quibbled with the ending. And we, Sarah and I were talking about that review earlier on, and we assume Mary, though we don't know, but we assume Mary Reynolds was black.
Given that she opens, that she doesn't know whether she should pass or not. It would seem to be the only way to make sense of that statement, yeah.
So what do we think about the ending or the endings?
Well, yeah, so it's a complicated thing, and I think that's actually a great little précis that Mary Reynolds offers there. I have to say that's I don't necessarily agree with her conclusions, but it's a terrific way of describing the novel and with great economy. But Matt was talking a moment ago about the central friendship of the characters, and I think it's really important that we say that it's, and one of the things I love about the book is that. So it's about these two women who've known each other since they were kids. They've lost touch. They get back in touch with each other. And they both can pass, but only one passes all the time. And her husband, her very racist husband, doesn't know that she's black, legally black. In fact, she's described at one point in the novel as more than one point in the novel, Larson makes it very clear she's blonde.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we have to do, I think, is, and I know I'm not yet answering your question, but I think it's really important before we even get to that question of the ending, is to realize that what Larson is saying to us is that a woman with white skin and blonde hair was considered black.
Yeah.
And that what she's doing is making us ask, what does this word even mean?
Yeah.
What does race even mean in such a context? And in fact, it's something that, the protagonist is called Irene. And it's something that Irene's husband says explicitly to her at one point late in the story. They're talking about passing and about how dangerous it is that Claire has decided to pass. And her husband, Irene's husband, who is too dark to pass, even if he wanted to, says if he understood why people passed, he would understand what race is. To me, it's a really important moment in the novel where Larson lays out front and center that race is not a given. It's not something that actually means anything, but America treats it as if it is, both socially, politically, and legally. So what she has is these two characters who have a kind of love-hate relationship. They've known each other forever. They are friends, but they're rivals. And what eventually and they threaten each other, their choices threaten each other because they're both making such different choices and they're both very anxious about the choices that the other one is making, as if the one's made the right choice and maybe you've made the wrong choice. What Larson does gradually is reveal that that Irene is a very unreliable perspective.
Yeah.
She's not actually narrating the novel, so I won't call her an unreliable narrator. I'll get a little pedantic about that. But it's closely focalized through her point of view, and she is a very unreliable, has a very unreliable perspective.
And her point of view shifts all the time.
And
it's really interesting.
And every now and then Larson will step in and tell us that she's a little bit self-deceiving, that Irene does something that Irene doesn't quite admit or that Irene doesn't quite want to know. But mostly we watch Irene's thought processes as she thinks through how she feels about Claire, what she and what she believes. Now, the blurb that you read, the Mary Reynolds takes the position that so what happens is Irene, over the course of the story, becomes convinced that Claire and Irene's husband are having an affair. Claire's very, very beautiful, this white-skinned, blonde-haired woman, but with, as the novel also makes clear, she has what it calls Negro eyes. So she has these amazing black eyes with this blonde hair and white face and luminous. And Irene becomes convinced that Brian and Claire are having an affair, but we're only ever inside Irene's head about this. So we don't have any independent confirmation. Neither Brian nor Claire ever cops to this in the course of the story. So we don't actually know whether they are for sure, although Irene becomes absolutely convinced of it. So the reviewer, Mary Reynolds there, accepts Irene's point of view, but there is some question even about that. But once Irene is certain that her husband is having an affair with Claire, the friendship comes under great strain. Irene becomes very worried about what would happen, and she just wants to get Claire out of their lives. And then they're all at a party together, and Irene's very angry. And we are told, Larson tells us more than once, that Irene is in a rage. Mm. And Larson very interestingly uses the word consistently throughout the story, the word repressed. That Irene has repressed her rage, that she's pushing back this rage. She's determined to keep up a false front to make sure that everything looks okay. And she goes to this party with their mutual friends, determined that nobody's going to know what happens, or that what she thinks is happening, what her suspicions. And what happens is that the racist husband bursts into the party, and Claire is standing by an open window, and through a moment of great confusion, Irene is standing right next to Claire, and Claire falls out of the window. And it is very much open to question why Claire falls out of the window. The way it's presented is, and the way the people around them at this party think, is that Claire either fell, or the suspicion is that it was her husband who pushed her, because he's racing on her, calling her terrible racial epithets because he's just discovered that she's black and that she's passing. But there is, since we're going full on spoiler, shall I just go right
for
what the question is? So there is a very, very strong implication that Irene may have pushed, there's more than one strong implication that Irene may have pushed Claire.
She ran across the room, her terror tinged with ferocity, and laid a hand on Claire's bare arm. One thought possessed her. She couldn't have Claire Kendry cast aside by Baloo. That's her husband. She couldn't have her free. And then the next thing is, you know, she can't remember what happened next, except that Claire disappears.
She says a few lines after that, Irene wasn't sorry. She was amazed, incredulous almost. What would the others think? That Claire had fallen? That she had deliberately leaned backward? Certainly one or the other, not dash.
Yeah.
So surely they would only think those two things, and there must be a third possibility. And the third possibility is, now it is, what happens is that then the other people think that it's that Baloo pushed her.
Yeah.
So there, one could say that the third possibility is that Baloo pushed Claire, but since Irene is standing right there, she would presumably know that.
I mean, I think this is one of the best written scenes. Mm. I mean, I think it's completely brilliant, and you're left guessing to the end, because there are so many possibilities.
So
I mean, I'm not really one for people falling out of windows as a way of solving novels either, but this is brilliant.
Can I go? So there's a tiny little clue that for me makes it clear with those two pieces that we've just read out that she does push her. And it's wonderful because it's so novelistic. And it's both on the same pages, these facing pages in my edition anyway. Just before the scene that John just read out, Irene's looking out the window, and she throws her cigarette out the window. And it says, the moon was just rising, and far behind the tall buildings, a few stars were creeping out. Irene finished her cigarette and threw it out, watching the tiny sparks drop slowly down to the white ground below. And then when Claire falls, she says, one moment, Irene thinks, one moment Claire had been there, a vital glowing thing like a flame of red and gold, and then she was gone. And so she's just, I believe that Larson has just foreshadowed it just a couple of paragraphs before by showing Irene throw the flame of red and gold out the window, and then out goes Claire.
I would also say that the husband's response kind of lets him off the hook. Mm-hmm. Again, this is why I love fiction, because you can't do this in a movie. Mm-hmm. It's just a really crap. This would be a really terrible scene in a film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what? Who? So this is what she says. There was a gasp of horror, and above it, a sound not quite human, like a beast in agony. Nig, my God, Nig. Nig is the name.
Mm-hmm. His unfortunate nickname for his wife.
For his wife. And I sort of feel you wouldn't need to put that in about a beast. And you know, if you wanted to suggest that the husband had been even remotely responsible for this,
We should also say that this, I'm keen to talk about how this ending was received and my theory about why it was received in such a way. But we should also say that the book actually has two endings, right? Depending on which edition you bought, relatively close to one another.
They all happened in 1929. So, sorry, I meant to say that and then I got excited by the cigarette and I forgot.
Did she revise?
We don't know.
We don't know.
In most editions now, what you'll find is a final paragraph that is from Irene's point of view, and the final two sentences are, through the great heaviness that submerged and drowned her, she was dimly conscious of strong arms lifting her up. And that phrase also, lifting her up, is very pointed in this novel. Dimly conscious of strong arms lifting her up, then everything was dark. And in a novel that's so concerned with racial politics, of course, and we've already just heard the line where the cigarette falls onto the white ground below, and now everything is dark. And this movement between white and dark is the movement of the novel. It's the tension of the novel. So in most editions, you'll see that ending.
I will be happy with that ending.
Yeah, it's a good ending,
that's,
right? It's a great ending.
I think that's what I've got. That's all I've read.
Is that what you've got?
Also, we haven't said yet, the novel opens with Irene fainting or feeling faint. Yeah. She feels close to fainting because of the heat. And that's why she encounters Claire again for the first time in many years, because she goes up to an all-white hotel to the roof to cool off. So Irene passes when it's convenient and is very contemptuous of Claire's decision to pass, but she doesn't admit to herself that she does pass when she feels like it. When it's useful, she'll pass too. Sure. She just doesn't do it all the time, and she doesn't lie to her husband and her close friends. But she knows what passing is, and she does it too. So she's disingenuous from the start. But so there's a beautiful symmetry to it where it starts out with her feeling faint and that reconnects her with Claire, and then to end with her feeling faint and everything being dark, that she's somehow chosen the black side of her life, if you want to put it crudely.
So double tick, excellent in the margin.
Right,
from teacher,
for symmetry, exactly. Well, good patterns, you know, nice metaphors. And but what happened was that in the first two editions, in 1929, there was one other paragraph, very short paragraph, and it ended like this. Centuries after, she heard the strange man saying, "Death by misadventure, I'm inclined to believe. Let's go up and have another look at that window." And that was how it closed. And then that paragraph dropped out of the third edition in 1929. So all of these are happening very rapidly in 1929, and it disappeared. And there is no evidence in any of the archives to suggest how it happened. So there's no letter from Larson saying get rid of this or restore it or anything. So nobody knows why it dropped out, whether it was just a mistake or whether some editor came in and made the decision, or whether Larson got in touch with her publishers and said, "I think I've made a mistake, get rid of this paragraph."
You know, you read the contemporary reviews and they're positive.
Yeah.
They are positive reviews.
Larson was quite well regarded.
But they all make a point of saying how they don't buy the ending in the same way that the review that we just read earlier. And I was thinking about this a lot, and I wonder whether it's because, and this brings us on to the next thing to talk about, which is context. This was a novel produced in a very specific place and time by a writer who was very closely identified with a specific group and would have been published as a novel about the race issue, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the book you think you're reading in 1929, perhaps the ending doesn't seem, you know, appropriate to what you've been reading about. But actually, we read it from all these other perspectives. I mean, the thing that was most striking to me for a novel of this era was how interior it is in terms of its psychology. And actually,
going up and down buildings as well.
To view this as a novel, almost a journalist, I guess what I'm saying, as a journalistic account, which is how it was published and how it would have been received.
No, I think you're right. But I think what you have is a novel that's written, as you say, in a context that's very much about what became known as protest fiction. And it became a very strong presumption that a black writer in the 1920s writing a novel about, as you say, the quote unquote race problem was therefore making a political statement about that race problem and was taking a position on the race problem and indeed was taking a position on how to solve the race problem. The politics of passing and the politics of what it means to be black at this time are really for the first time during the Harlem Renaissance, which is the what the era is known as. I just realized I haven't even said that yet. So the 1920s In the 1920s, what happens is a great many really brilliant African American writers, artists,
including
Zora Neale Hurston, including Langston Hughes, but also some lesser known writers who are really worth rediscovering. Jean Toomer, who wrote an amazing book called Cain, and they were all known at the time as the New Negro Movement, but now we call it the Harlem Renaissance, partly to get away from that term, Kante Cullen. Yeah. Harlem became a kind of locus for great African-American talent in much the way that Paris was receiving a much European and American, white American talent. They were going to Paris, but there was this concentration, a really exciting time of ideas and energy and artistic output, and these brilliant Black writers in particular coming forward and saying, we are not just these caricatured and characters in somebody else's fiction. Here's our voice. Here's our identity. Here's who we are.
But we should also say that, A, that moment was pretty brief, right? And the second thing is that Larson said this herself, that she was able to be published by white publishers because the Harlem Renaissance was perceived almost like a great 20s fad.
Yeah.
One of the great, you know, these things that rise up and burn very brightly and then disappear.
Well, there was a great deal of...
Yeah, because she was published by Knopf.
She was published by Knopf.
How does Nella fit into this, though? Was she, you know, there's only two books written by her. Mm. I know she was a nurse. How does she fit in with the rest of the literary world then? Was she connected to it?
She was absolutely connected to it, yeah. She was friends with all of them, or you know, acquaintances with all of them, let's put it that way. They're all very much in the same social circles and reading each other's work and commenting on each other's work. And so you'll see E.B. Du Bois reviews Larson, she's in conversations with Langston Hughes. So they all know each other. They're all reading each other's work.
Is she young at the time that she writes it?
She is. She's 28, 29. I think she was born in 1900. I've done that, but I think that's right.
1891.
Sorry, she's older than I thought. So 1891, she would have been closer to 40.
So the big question is, what happens next?
Yeah, well, indeed. And what happened with Larson was a great deal of controversy. She was working on her third book. She got a Guggenheim to work on her third book. And she was accused of plagiarism.
Oh.
And there was a real scandal, and she fell off the map. There's a really good biography that came out just a few years ago called In Search of Nella Larson that actually tries to lay all this stuff out, because Larson really did kind of disappear. One of the reasons...
And sought to disappear.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, wasn't rejected per se.
Well, partly that, but part of her response to being rejected was to walk away from the whole thing.
And did he get to the bottom of the plagiarism? She doesn't strike me. She's such a careful, precise writer.
She is. I believe it's one of those things where the jury is still out.
Right.
There are those who believe it. There are those who don't.
Who was supposed to be the party that was plagiarized?
It was a British writer whose name escapes me.
Yeah, me too. I should know, but I can't remember.
Not a well-known writer.
And were we talking a large amount of material?
It was a short story. The story, as you read it, is she was so sort of disgusted by the way she'd been treated.
Exactly, that she was humiliated and furious.
And went back to nursing.
But we would add that the moment, this is why it's so interesting about this passing being a product of a place and time. She also had a sense, we think, that the moment had gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what happens, remember, this book, Passing, comes out in 1929, and we've only been talking about the racial context, but there's something else pretty important that's about to happen in 1929, which is the stock market's going to crash.
Yeah.
So all of the Roaring Twenties comes roaring, if you will, to a halt.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Depression is on you. And believe me, there wasn't a lot of spare energy and sympathy among the white people who suddenly find themselves losing all of their money and status and power, and everybody's, you know, scrabbling, and suddenly they had found the whole Harlem Renaissance thing as part of the Jazz Age. It was all part of the decadence of the age to be interested in Black people like animals in a zoo. It was all part of this kind of carnivalesque atmosphere. And once that ends and the Depression comes, then that changed for most of the writers of the Harlem Renaissance. The writers and the artists found that their publishers were going out of business. They didn't have an audience anymore. They weren't able to sell their books in the same way. Zora Neale Hurston also ended up, ended up a maid and was buried in an unmarked grave. And Alice Walker had to go find her and rediscover Hurston. And Walker did that a little bit earlier, and then Larson just kind of happened next. So this happened particularly to the black women writers of the era. The men had a little bit more luck at sticking around, which is partly what Larson is getting at.
I mean, it seems so tragic because you don't get a sense that this is a woman who has written herself out. I mean,
she's just getting going.
Yeah.
So Passing does okay at the time. It goes through three editions and it sells 5,000 or 6,000 copies, I believe.
Yeah.
And then the book kind of disappears, doesn't it, for 40 years? When do people start reading it and in writing it again? The thing I have to say about Passing, I did think when I realised how... I have an edition here where it has like 80 pages of the novel and then 450 pages of essays about the novel. And I did think, well, if this book didn't exist, American academia would have invented it.
Right? In a sort of pale fire kind of.
So interpretable in so many ways on so many issues which are very alive in the States right now.
Absolutely.
And, well, I think anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I think that's what makes it great fiction. It is... Yeah. It is about race, but Passing is every human culture. There is an equivalent.
Absolutely.
Know, people, whether it's class, people, you know, it's
a Gatsby, you know.
It's
trying to be what you're not and what you don't feel you are.
Imposter syndrome, the fear of being uncovered.
Exactly. Of Claire is also described throughout the novel in terms of masks consistently, that she wears this mask in this sense, exactly, that everybody is kind of wearing a mask. And Irene's very conscious of Claire's mask, but she's much less conscious of her own masks, but she's wearing masks too. And one of the reasons why I think it still reads in such a contemporary way is because, as you just suggested, Andrew, we're still absolutely obsessed with and perplexed by questions of identity.
Yeah.
And we're still seeking categories. And what I love about Larson is she explodes categories. She is she's interested in categories because she understands how powerful they are, but she doesn't believe in them. Yeah. She is attacking categories here all the way through, undermining them, shredding them whenever she can, exploding them, just saying these are not sufficient to who people actually are and what lives are actually like.
I love that about the book, actually. That's probably my favorite thing about the novel is the switching constantly of point of view.
Yeah.
You know,
like
we were talking about earlier, that Irene will tell then she'll tell you something else that doesn't quite match up.
The reaction shots are amazing.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. Like, it is. It's really cinematic.
When she you know, she loses control of her voice in a crucial scene with her husband. Yeah. Also, reading about Noah Larson's biography, she left her husband or her husband left her. There was an infidelity in her marriage and how, I mean, there's definitely autobiographical elements in the book.
In both books,
But that extraordinary thing of she loses control of her voice and then, you know, his reaction to her losing control, and that's in the moment that she knows what's happened between Claire and Brian, her husband. It's just, it's great.
Now, we are keen now, so having covered all these issues
of our seats.
Matthew, do you have anything tenuous to bring to the conversation?
Well, it's not really that tenuous. I think it's kind of, this week I wanted to...
After last week's, frankly...
Yeah, so this week's far more...
Emasculating.
I mean, ridiculous. Yeah.
Tenuous
to the
humiliate
point of...
Andy.
Yeah.
So I've got nothing like that. I kind of, what I was interested in this book was why, when I read it on the Kindle, it felt so contemporary, why I didn't immediately know when it had been written. So I just wanted to find out what else was published that year.
Oh, 1929 was a good year for American literature.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, there's some extraordinary books. There's, you know, there's The Sound and the Fury, the Faulkner book, there's Farewell to Arms.
Sound and the Fury is considered a much better book than Sanctuary, for the record.
Okay.
Take note, Jane.
But also Farewell to Arms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. But the sort of two that I thought were kind of interesting and had some relevance to Passing was Virginia Woolf's A Woman of One's Own.
God, I love this.
And All Quiet on the Western Front.
But also... more extraordinary, Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan, I think Tarzan and the Lost Empire was published then, which also kind of really, I think, just shows the incredible range of views about all the stuff that's in there, race, gender. It was really going on in 1929.
The first Tarzan novel is about 1912, 1913, isn't it?
We should say as well that Nella Larson probably read... many of those books.
Oh,
she works as a librarian, right? She was the children's librarian at the head children's librarian at the New York Public Library. That she had read Ulysses very early on. She got somebody to bring her a copy of Ulysses. And actually, she dies in 1964. And She just dies in bed. Yeah, but she dies in bed. She doesn't turn up for a shift at the hospital.
Yeah.
And they find her a week later where she's sitting up in bed reading.
Yeah.
So what will happen to one week where we'll be sat around the table, where's Andy? He's not here.
Finnegan's wake again.
Yeah, yeah.
The final thing that I've been interesting me this week is really thinking about that Bowie list again and thinking about us, what we're doing here, which is kind of recommending books to people. So I asked my brother, Ewan, who is he's just a guy that knows this stuff, if he could tell me... Well, the reason why he knows this stuff is he wrote an amazing book called The Story of Writing, called The Golden Thread, The History of Writing. So I asked him if he could tell me when he thought the earliest record of someone recommending books to other people was. When was the first recommended reading list? And he came up with Cassiodorus in the 6th century, who was an Italian... monk, he was also prime minister, who's kind of the equivalent of the prime minister in Italy for a while. And he wrote a book called Institutioni, forgive my pronunciation, which was a reading list for monks at his monastery, which was, this is what monks need to read.
That's fantastic.
How many of them had you read?
Very poor script.
Yeah. Well, listen.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Sarah, so much.
Brilliant.
This brilliant choice, everybody. That book, if you just switch back on, you're going to the ending.
Yeah.
Right? So after the aliens land, it's pretty crazy. But passing by Nella Larson.
Get through the car chase.
Passing by Nella Larson, we should also say you could buy that for your Kindle for less than £1.
Yeah.
So please do. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel. Thanks for giving us an opportunity to read it.
My pleasure.
And you can find us on the usual places, Backlisted Podcast on Facebook, at Backlisted Pod on Twitter, and on the Unbound site, unbound.co.uk.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. You can choose to listen to Backlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted, where you also get bonus content of 2 episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks.